Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I am Jamie, back and ready. John, how you doing, man?
Dude, I don't want to be super mushy, but it's good to hear your voice on here, brother.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. I super appreciate you covering for me. You got a whole week of all of our shows done by yourself, and I'm very thankful for that. And I got a lot of messages from listeners with their condolences. I did have a big loss in my family, and I'm very appreciative of all of those, but I am back now and don't intend to miss anything for the foreseeable future. I do think I made it 7 years without missing an episode.
I didn't make it a year before I missed my first episode. I remember I had a bad stomach bug when we were set to record with a guest. So, but I feel like I've missed another one or two in there somewhere. So first off, yeah, I'm terribly sorry about your loss. And you and I have definitely spoke off the air about all that, but yeah, condolence. I mean, like, how in the world do you go seven years without missing an episode? And we release at least two episodes a week for the longest of that time, and now we're doing like five a week. I can't do the math. It's so many.
It's a lot, and I don't know. We've streamlined our processes and made it more manageable. So thankful for that, but I don't see myself missing anymore. But thanks again to you and everybody.
Well, just so you know,
kind messages,
we're on the same page. If you ever want to step away from the show, like, it's we're both in or out kind of thing.
Well, I guess a lot of good feedback about how well John did without me. So,
well, were being kind, because it felt terrible.
I thought I might not be welcome back.
I was lonely. There was no, I was just talking for a long time. Yeah, I hated it. Welcome back. You're not allowed to go anywhere else.
I also want to give a thank you to Debbie C82 for a 5-star review that came in over on Apple Podcasts. It said, "This podcast came highly recommended and it did not disappoint." Debbie, I would love to know who recommended it. Tag your friend. Tell them. We'll give them a shout out as well. We appreciate that.
Yeah. Don't forget about Patreon, guys. Patreon is a way for you to get a bonus episode each and every month. I have some podcasts that I listen to, and I hate when I've listened to all the content they have available and I just need a little bit more. Well, Patreon is your way to get that. You can visit patreon.com, patreon.com, search up True Crime Cast, and you'll have 7 years of a monthly bonus episode for you to enjoy. And as if that isn't enough, if you go ahead and download that and subscribe, you get our regular episodes when they're available early and ad-free.
Absolutely.
I say when available, because there was one last week that we were getting up. I was getting up just right in time.
Yeah, it's we were a little behind due to my absence, but I think we'll be right on track with that again. And man, we're coming back and starting off with a bang. This has come recommended from several listeners. It's been on our list for a while, and ready to dig into it.
All right, man. Well, why don't you get the ball rolling?
We're going to talk about Deanna Seifert today, who is the only daughter of Bob and Betty Seifert. Bob worked in a factory. Betty worked at a local fast food restaurant. And they had three kids, Deanna, and they had two sons, Robert and Brian. And Deanna was also the middle child of the three. They lived on Essex Street in a town called Warren in the Detroit area of Michigan. Warren was really the biggest suburb of Detroit in 1992 when this incident happened back in throughout the early 90s, really. In early 92, Bob lost his job at the factory, so the family was coming upon some really hard times. I know that's something that never goes away. There are always people who are having hard times financially, and this hit the Seifert family in 92.
Have you ever been through and traveled to Detroit?
I have not.
Yeah, dude, it's the automotive industry was huge, especially early on in the mid 1900s. Things were booming. I've been to this town, and it is, you could tell that at one time it was beautiful, but in the 90s, things started being sent overseas, and a lot of people lost their jobs, and you can drive through Detroit and Warren and see what was once this prosperous place has just fallen into ruins because all the jobs are gone.
Yeah, it's tough. And that area has been hit. I mean, obviously a pinnacle of the motor vehicle industry is kind of what it's known for. And they took a hit there. They did make it a priority for Deanna, being the only girl in the home, to get her own phone in her bedroom on her birthday, which was May 7th of 1992. And she was 10. She's right at our age. She's right between my age and your age, John. So I definitely remember that feeling of wanting slash getting a phone in my room, getting some privacy. And for those of you who may not know, phones used to just be in your house and attached to the wall.
I was going to say, when I was researching this case, I remember vividly the feeling of getting my first phone in my room. This was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's probably the same, but it was as big of a deal for us as it would be for like giving your kids their very new first time iPhone, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was a level of independence that was brand new, and it was awesome.
Obviously not comparable in technology today, but as far as, I don't know, like you said, the freedom, the ability to have some privacy, it's huge for a kid.
Yeah. On the other landlines in the home, there might be four phones in the house, but at any moment someone could pick up and listen to your conversation. Or if they were on the phone, your friends would get the busy signal when they were calling.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can't go understated how big of a deal that was. Not really a factor in today's case.
Yeah, but we'll talk about call waiting at some point in the future.
Just interesting side note. So she was a student at Elizabeth Little Elementary School, and she had recently won an award in her science class. On Saturday, May 9th, just 2 days after her birthday, Deanna was introduced to a girl who lived on her street. Her name was Lindsay McCracken. Lindsay lived just 8 houses away from Deanna, and the two were hoping to have a sleepover. This was something that was super common when I was this age, man. My friends and I would either crash at my house, I would go to their house. Even at 10 years old, we would just stay up eating popcorn or whatever and watching movies or playing video games. And it was awesome.
I think it still happens, but people are much more cautious to allow your kid to go in a home where you don't know people. So it usually has to happen now more when it's the families or friends and there's some trust there. So I think it's less common, but when it does happen, still just as awesome as it was then.
Yep. She was given permission to go to the sleepover, and Deanna promised her parents that she would be home Sunday at noon. So she would go over to the sleepover on Saturday. And that Sunday was a very important day, Jamie. It was Mother's Day. So you got to be home in time to at least have lunch with mom, if not take her out for Mother's Day. She actually had her own plans to make her mom a flower, like a flower out of pipe cleaner. So it was going to be like a handmade flower that she made. So just a sweet gesture to show her mama some love on Mother's Day.
Lindsay's house was very crowded. She lived with her mom, whose name was Denise, her dad, Don Cricken, her siblings, and a woman lived there named Lori Menzo. During the time of the sleepover, though, Don was serving 90 days in jail for a parole violation. Lindsay also had invited sisters Susie and Sarah over for the sleepover. So it was not just one person visiting another. It was a big group of friends. Now, that sleepover was pretty typical. It had cake, it had games, it had talking and gabbing and staying up pretty late. Although, I will say, they went to bed about 11. That's pretty early for a sleepover.
Yeah, I would think so. But they're 10, so. But in the 90s, parents didn't really care what we did, so.
Yeah, maybe they were just tired. It's a long week. Lindsay and Deanna were asleep in Lindsay's bed, and the two other girls were sleeping on a mattress in the floor, so all in the same room. Denise checked on the girls around 1 in the morning. She went and locked the front door, went and locked the back door, and then she herself, feeling like the home was secure and everybody was safe in bed, went on to bed herself.
Now, Denise woke up at 9 a.m., and she went to check on the kids. And at that time, she noticed that Deanna was gone, but she had left her change of clothes behind. Well, Denise didn't think much of it, though. She figured Deanna had got up at some point in the middle of the night and walked home and just left her stuff behind because kids are kids. They're forgetful. They do that stuff. But when Betty Seifert calls later that day around 2:30 to ask where Deanna is, that's when, of course, panic sets in. Deanna was not home, and she was not at Lindsay's house, and no one knew where she was at. No one had seen her. The Seifert family called the police immediately, and they were able to send someone out to take the missing persons report. They also checked the McCracken house, and there was no sign of a forced entry. Denise checked the doors. They were locked, and it didn't appear as if there was any break-ins or anything. It appears that if an intruder did come in, they let themselves in, and they locked up after they left. So if someone came to the house to take Deanna, they let themselves in. It's wild. They began canvassing the neighborhood, but they already had a prime suspect in mind, and that would be 22-year-old Andrew James Trombley.
Trombley was a son of Don's sister. Remember, Don was Lindsay's dad, Joyce Cricken. This made Trombley Lindsay's cousin, of course. He used to live in the McCracken house with them, so obviously they have an extended family situation. He wasn't living there during the time of the sleepover, but it was discovered that Trombley still had a key to the McCracken house. Trombley was well known to law enforcement as a teenager. He had a long list of charges ranging from weapon possession to car theft. In May of 92, Trombley had been out of prison for 2 months after he had served 5 years for car theft. So certainly somebody that's no stranger to the law and has a propensity to get himself into trouble. He had pulled the driver from a running car, beat him up, and stole the car. So this isn't just a matter of theft. This is definitely a situation where there was an assault, and he showed violence. It wasn't just about the money. While he was in prison, he received 54 conduct citations for infractions ranging from assault to creating a disturbance. John, you and I, when we did Paradigm, we looked at the prison records of those that are in prison for the Lilylid murders, and we kind of went through their infractions, and they've been in prison for 30 years. I don't think any of them had 54 citations on their record. If they did, it was just one of them.
I was going to say, if so, it's just one of them. The other ones haven't had like any in that amount of, in a very long amount of time. So yeah, this guy's, he's up to no good.
He's certainly not getting out early for good behavior. He was arrested that evening after Deanna had gone missing and not shown up on Mother's Day, but the search continued for Deanna. And we get back, we'll talk about that search and if Trombley was really the guy they were looking for.
So Trombley was arrested, but it would take 2 months until they discovered what happened to Deanna. It's interesting, and we can process it now or we can process it later, but they made an arrest really quickly. And I don't know that at the time of the arrest, they really had evidence to make an arrest.
Yeah, I do think this is rare. A lot of cases that we talk about, they want to make sure they got what they need. They don't want to bring somebody in and then have to let them go and not be able to get the evidence they need. And sometimes that's just due to the fact that they can get more information about somebody if they don't know they're looking into them. But we talk about the Brooklyn Farthing case. Pretty quickly, I think the prime suspect was known and is still known, has never been arrested. So.
Yeah. So this one, I don't know, it's kind of interesting, but like I said, it would take 2 months until they really knew what happened to Deanna. The gentleman named Ron Elkins, who is not at all a suspect, but he is the owner of a machine shop. It's called Rotary and Engineering Corp. And this business was less than a mile away from the McCracken house. On July 13th, 1992, he went out back of his workplace and noticed that there was a 4x4 metal bin, which was placed between his building and another building close to the property that he did not own. And he said he didn't know what really drew him to the bin that day. He'd seen it before, but this time he decided to move the weeds, which were laying on top, and see what was inside the bin. He would say that he'd seen that bin all the time, and he just assumed that it was the neighbor's bin.
Right.
So he just wanted to check it out and see what it was, because never noticed it before. And what he found was a horrific discovery. He said, quote, "I went and looked inside and found the body. At that time, it was a young girl, badly decomposed. It looked like she had blonde hair," end quote.
Again, this is 2 months after Deanna had gone missing. So she had been there for quite some time, if she was placed there shortly after her disappearance. While police couldn't make a positive ID with forensic tests, they didn't have dental records available. DNA really wasn't that big at the time. They were able to decide that it was Deanna Seifert based on the descriptions and pictures that they had. Sergeant William Romano of the Warren Police Department said, "It was the body of a white female with blonde hair, badly decomposed. The clothing was similar to what Deanna Seifert was wearing at the time of her disappearance. Her underwear were on her, but had been turned inside out." So it seems they were taking off of her for reasons we'll talk about in a minute, but placed back on by whoever did this. At this time, her parents were called down to the police station shortly after they found the body. Bob's sister Carol acted as the family's spokesperson and said that Bob and Betty went into seclusion after they came home from the police station. John, I can imagine getting this phone call. I mean, they know she's been missing for 2 months. And I don't know that the anxiety, worry, and anticipation of worst case scenario would go away. I would think that 2 months would just be constant torture for the Seifert family.
Bro, I can't even begin to imagine it. We both have daughters. And I cannot even fathom how much of a mess I would be.
And so she's been missing for over 2 months, and there has to be at least a little bit of hope that, you know, maybe she's okay somewhere. But they got this call finding out that she was found and was no longer living. Carol, again, who's Bob's sister, speaking for the Seifert family, said, "They're real upset. It's real hard on them. Neither of them slept last night. Maybe it was an omen." Neither of them had slept the night before they found the body. So she's suggesting maybe they kind of knew that it was coming, or somehow they were preparing for this news. The medical examiner said he believed that the body was Deanna Seifert, again, based on descriptions and other things. He said that the body had extensive fractures of the skull. And he believed that if those injuries were inflicted before she died, then that was likely the cause of death, because that definitely would have been fatal. Investigators theorized a piece of a cement step that was found out in the parking lot may have been the murder weapon. There was also blood in the parking lot near where the body was found, so authorities believe that right beside that bin in that parking lot was where she was murdered.
So let's go through some of the witness testimony that came out. Adeline Dietrich lived near the McCracken house and testified at trial that she had went downstairs her home at 3 a.m. and walked by the front door. As she walked by, she saw Trombley's van parked in front of the McCracken house. Then she said that she saw a man coming out of the yard carrying a girl, and it looked like Trombley, but she did not see his face. She said that the man put the child down next to the van and fumbled, trying to get the driver's door open. The man carried the child to the back of the van, put her down again, opened the rear door, and either tossed her to somebody or simply threw her in the van. Either way, making a toss in motion with her body. Then he got into the rear of the van and closed the door. And about 30 seconds later, she said that someone got into the driver's seat and took off without turning on the headlights.
Now, my understanding of this is that whoever this was, if it was Trombley, simply just climbed through the van, not another person necessarily, although based on what she saw, there certainly could have been somebody else in the van.
Well, and I think you will hear some other testimony that could relate or reveal that there may have been more people there. So, again, keep in mind, this sighting was at 3 a.m.
Another neighbor of the McCracken said that he saw Trombley's van in front of their house around 12:45 a.m. Going back to the timeline, Lindsay's mom, Denise, checked on the kids around 1 a.m. before she went to bed. But she just looked around the house and she locked the doors. Then a van matching the description of Trombley's was seen by a gentleman named John Silva around 2 or 3 a.m. near the Hitching Post bar. At that time, Trombley was living in an apartment right above the Hitching Post bar. So we see the van around his house around that time. Perhaps he was driving around. He had potentially picked her up and gone back to his place. There are just so many sightings of this van around the time of the crime. John said he looked out the window and he heard glass breaking and he saw three men walking down the middle of the street ahead of the van. The van stopped in front of John's house when a woman approached the passenger side of the van and started talking to whoever was inside. John couldn't see the driver, but he heard one of the men outside the van say, "Are you coming to help us do this, bitch? If not, get your effing ass back home." I find it kind of interesting that I only choose to bleep out one of those, but that's kind of where I'm at.
I feel like that was made for TBS back in the day, right? Like they would bleep out some words or...
Yeah,
it was interesting how they kind of chose arbitrarily which words to cut out.
That was not intentional, but I did bleep out the F word. John said that the woman walked away and then the men continued walking for another two blocks before they got back into the van and drove away. So here we see somebody around three. So this would have potentially been after Deanna was missing from the house and three guys were around this van. So like you said, there's potential for other individuals to be a part of this.
So Donna Sherman would testify, and she said that at around 3:30 or 4 a.m. that same night, she saw a van that looked like Tom Lee's gray van come to the rear entrance of the Hitching Post bar parking lot and then go east at a high speed. And she says that she remembers this because she was getting out of a cab at her parents' house at the time and was almost sideswiped by the van. I was wondering, like, yeah, how would you remember that detail? It's because the van almost hit her. So that's going to be memorable in your mind.
Also got a question for you. This is about the fourth eyewitness account of this van in the wee hours of the morning. Does nobody in this town sleep?
I know, right?
The reason that crimes are committed at this time is because you think there are no witnesses, but there are witnesses everywhere in the suburbs of Chicago, apparently, in the middle of the night.
So she said there were two white men with long hair inside the van. She identified the driver as Trombley, though she had never met him before the trial. Donna's sister was coming out the front door of her parents' house as Donna was getting out of the cab. Again, another person awake at a weird time. She corroborated her sister's story, identified a photo of Trombley's van as the one that she saw that night, and said that she had also seen it many times parked outside the Hitching Post bar. The cab driver also testified the cab was almost hit by this van and identified Trombley as the driver. So this speeding van that was going by and almost hit him, the cab driver said he was able to get a look at the driver and it was Trombley.
And it sounds like it's a unique vehicle around the town. So people definitely notice who it is and Trombley was well known so people could identify him. After examination, there were three pubic hairs found in Deanna's underwear. Again, she's 10. These are likely not hers. Experts testified that the hairs likely came from three different Caucasian individuals. None of the hairs belonged to Trombley. And the parking lot area where Deanna's body was found in that bin was littered with metal chips that came from the metal shops located nearby. Again, this is an industry-based area, so there are a lot of factories making a lot of different things, so there's a lot of debris, I guess, in the parking lot. There were shavings that were similar to those found in the parking lot embedded in the rear tires of Trombley's van, suggesting that he had at least driven through that or a similar parking lot at some time that day, because they arrested him the day she disappeared. So it's not like he had a lot of time to hide evidence or to clean his tires. Experts testified that at least one of the chips was indistinguishable from the chips in the parking lot where Deanna's body was discovered. In my older age, I feel like I become more and more cynical about what scientific evidence is actually real. During the Richard Allen trial for Delphi, I feel like the gun evidence with the round that was cycled through it was kind of misunderstood or misinterpreted. And here, how do you tell that it's a chip of metal had to be from this place with so many factories around? So I question that a bit.
Yeah, and I think eventually in the trial, they were able to say, you know what? I don't think we know this for sure, so we're just going to move on.
And they did find some similar metal chips in the parking lot around his apartment, which again is above the Hitching Post bar. So there, it was spread around where they knew Trombley had been on his van, around his apartment. But, you know, it could have been around the whole town.
Well, I mean, they did their due diligence in court. They actually pulled in an expert from the FBI in Washington, D.C. to come in and to review these fragments of metal to identify, can they be the ones that were in the parking lot? And it seems as if, you know, there was so much traffic in and out of that business that these clippings were all over the road. So you cannot, with 100%, even if they are the very same chips, you cannot say for certain they were picked up in the parking lot versus in the road. Does that make sense? So
yeah, or that they came from his car. They could have come from other vehicles too.
Exactly. So when investigators examined the tennis shoes that Trombley was wearing when he was arrested, they found dried blood in the toe and the heel area. Unfortunately, they did not immediately preserve this blood. So by the time that it was tested, it was degraded so much so that the DNA testing simply could not be done. They were, however, able to determine the blood type, which was AB positive, and it was also positive for an antigen called PGM. So that was AB positive, PGM positive, PGM1 positive, which all that to say, this was an extremely rare blood type.
Right.
Like less than 10% of the world's population have this. So while they didn't have the DNA profile to say this is definitely her blood, it does strongly point to there's a high likelihood that it was her. Also, there were 4 fingerprints that were later found inside the rear passenger side window of Trombley's van, and these were identified as Deanna's. Jamie, I found this interesting. They were able to do this because, like, she wouldn't have a fingerprint on profile with the police department.
Right.
So what they did was they took, like, I don't know, 30 pieces of her homework that they knew she had done, fingerprint tested those, and then pulled a profile from those, which matched the fingerprints used in the van. Oftentimes, I feel like we're talking about what the police didn't do right. Here, I think they were doing everything they could to try to prove what happened to her.
Yeah, you and I kind of talked about, I don't even know that we questioned it earlier, but the quick arrest, and I don't think that was an issue, and I've yet to see an issue with the early investigation. After all this testimony, there was really no room for reasonable doubt. Andrew Trombley was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 40 to 60 years in prison. He continues to maintain his innocence. As of a couple of years ago, the town of Warren opened a playground in honor and memory of Deanna Seifert. Both her parents were still alive at the time, and they both said that they were in awe of it, and they were very, very grateful that the community had kept Deanna in mind. This was 23 years after she had been killed. Bob said that hearing about the playground brought back a lot of emotion, which anytime you have to revisit a situation in a real way does. He said he had one big piece of advice for parents. Always watch and be aware of where your child is going today. And I think that's obviously solid advice. And he's coming from a place of, unfortunately, probably some regret, even though the fault here falls on Andrew Trombley and then any potential accomplices who were never tried in this case. Trombley is serving the time alone, even though there were other witnesses, and Trombley didn't name other people that helped him because he says he didn't do it.
That's something that I personally don't like. The police department should have evidence taken from her underwear that would implicate other folks in this crime. So I can't in good faith say they got the sole person responsible because, you know, did he murder her? Did one of the accomplices and he just happened to be there? We still don't have the full story. Trombley's in jail for the rest of his life, but there are other people involved that are not in prison serving time for her justice. This is going to sound crazy. I'm going to call the Warren County Police Department and just ask, like, this is not a cold case, so there's probably no investigation still open, but you have, at the very least, a rape suspect that has never been held accountable. And you have evidence in your possession that we now can test and get DNA from. What are you going to do about it?
Right. And I wonder how, you're right, if this is a cold case, obviously there are some where people in police departments are just waiting for technology to catch up. But what about these situations where it has been, you have a person in prison, but there was evidence of more? Who's the person that's looking at these and saying, you know what, we should probably check on that again? I don't know. And I bet so many of these go untested.
Let me throw another curveball at you. Did you notice what he was charged with? Second degree
murder. Yep.
If you can identify these people now and they tell you a story that may be different than the version of events that you've been led to believe, is there a scenario where they could be convicted for their involvement, whether that be a rape or, you know, assisting in the murder, and then he be tried and convicted for first degree murder? Is that
that's not a good question.
Necessarily double jeopardy because he's been convicted of second degree murder. Can you somehow change that to first if you have new evidence that comes in from these people?
Yeah, I don't know about the new charge and if that would happen. You said he'll spend the rest of his life in prison. He was sentenced to 40 to 60 years.
I misspoke. He's eligible for parole in just 4 years from now.
I don't think he'll be paroled, but you never know. I do think we could look at some resentencing based on what you learn there. But you're right. We could get DNA off of those hairs and potentially find more people who are involved. Like we said with the playground, this would bring up emotions for the family and the community would have to relive some of this. But I think the majority of people would say, if we can get more complete justice and hold people accountable, then let's do it. So I'll be interested to see how your phone call does. It would be, would love for some listeners to make that phone call as well, as it seems, I don't know, fairly likely that more people were involved in what happened here. So would love to hear more from that. And if nothing else, they could test those hairs and maybe prove that, well, it was from her home, or it was other people in the Seaford house or whatever, that may show that other people weren't involved. But who knows? I would love to see that followed up on, at the very least, just do some testing and see what you come up with. But fascinating case, obviously heartbreaking. I struggle anytime we do a case with kids, and I have a 10-year-old daughter, and you have a daughter just a little older than that. So this certainly hits home. And as parents, I encourage you all to go follow Killer Bee Tactical on YouTube and TikTok. He gives a lot of safety information on how to protect your kids. He partners with Bark with their phones and watches. We got to meet him at CrimeCon last year, and he's a great guy, and he gives a lot of good safety tips for things to look for to keep yourself and your family safe. And that's certainly a person I follow and gotten a lot of tips from him. So do what you need to do. Keep your family safe. Be aware of where they are and what they're doing.
Guys, we appreciate you. Jamie, again, good to have you back, buddy. Please don't leave me again. And guys, we appreciate you. We love you.
Yep. We'll be back tomorrow with an episode of True Crime to Go.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast. distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.